I'm Yasha. This is a mini course about hard spin gravity, which I've been learning recently. So we'll have today, tomorrow, and then Friday. So it's much of the literature on this is difficult to read if you're approaching it for the first time. The places I found that are more accessible than others is this nice review from 96 by Vasilyev, who is like the chief developer, father, godfather, judge, jury, and executioner of this theory. There is a more recent and detailed review by Didenko and Skvortsov, and 4 years ago, Simone Gyombi did a very nice mini course here. Okay, now I have a slightly idiosyncratic approach to things. So for more details on those aspects, so I have this little paper about the geometry of twisters with a cosmological constant. Then there is this paper where I write down an alternative version of the theory which lives on a non-dynamical spacetime. Okay, so an ulterior motive of these lectures, if I have enough time, is to introduce this, but the main goal is to teach the theory as such. Okay. So whenever writing actual equations, I will use the patriotic sign convention of Lorentz signature and positive cosmological constant. Okay. So the approximate plan is that today we do some introductory blah blah. By tomorrow, we should have the free field equations in the correct smart form that lends itself to nonlinear deformation. And then on Friday, we'll have the full interacting Vasilyev equations. Okay. So let's begin with some zoology. What is it that we're talking about? So hard spin theory is one of two theories that we have in mathematical physics that is more than a field theory. And the other slightly less famous cousin is, of course, string theory. Okay? So to have a bird's eye, very imprecise comparison of the two, a string theory talks about seems to be the unique way to talk about the interactions of relativistic extended objects. And hard spin theory is likewise the apparently unique way to talk about interacting massless fields with spin beyond the dreaded threshold of spin 2, which is general relativity. Okay? String theory in its own right, without holography, is understood at the quantum perturbative level, although in many quantum perturbative corners. Okay, and hard spin theory is understood non-perturbatively, but only at the classical level. That is, we have field equations. And we don't have the beginnings of an ordinary quantization, even there is no Lagrangian or Hamiltonian language. Okay. Strings like SUSY. Higher spins can live with SUSY, but don't have to. Strings prefer a zero or negative cosmological constant. Higher spins must have it non-zero. But can live with either sign. Okay. They both contain infinitely many fields. In that sense, they are more than field theories. They both contain a massless spin 2 field, which we can call a graviton. And they both apparently admit a non-perturbative quantum definition through ADS-CFT. That is, ADS-CFT tells us how to make strings non-perturbative, and it tells us how to make a higher spin theory quantum. Now, the reason I ended up interested in this theory is essentially the combination of these three facts, that it's something like gravity. It has a graviton in it. It can live in the sitter with a positive cosmological constant. It admits holographic quantization. So as far as I'm concerned, this is the reasonable context to talk about DSCFT. And the seminal paper that does that, that defines DSCFT higher spin model, is this one by Andy Strominger and friends. Okay. Other people like the theory for other reasons. You might think that it's the theory of everything, and that's why you should study it. You might think that you're a string theorist, and this is a toy model for string theory, and that's why you deign to study it. You may think that it is string theory in an alternative formulation, and this appears to be true, at least in some cases. Or you may decide that this is a case study for holography, where it appears to be more tractable, and you can have a unified picture of the bulk and the boundary at once. Okay. So we will not actually talk about holography, except in this cursory introductory way, but we'll focus on the theory itself and the bulk, its equations, and its structure. Okay. We will try to highlight what are the tools and ways of thinking that go into it that can be useful for our heads more generally. Okay, so what is the theory's spectrum? So it has one massless field of each spin. And when I say each spin, that means, so we'll be talking about the bosonic theory only, so it's either all the integers, or there is a consistent truncation to only the even integers. Now, we know that each massless field is supposed to come with the gauge symmetry, so if you have infinitely many massless fields, you should have an infinite dimensional gauge group, this is called the higher spin gauge group. Now, since the gauge symmetry for the spin 2 field is the space-time symmetry group, then the higher spin group is an infinite dimensional extension of that. And it only has finite dimensional subgroups with the spin 2 and lower. Okay, so what this means for theories of massless fields is that if you include one field with the spin above 2, then you must include the entire infinite tower, either like this or like this, because the gauge group will generate them all. Okay. And all the fields in the theory, all this infinity of fields, form a single multiplet, basically, under this gauge group. So all this is a bit like supersymmetry, but on steroids. Okay, so you have fields with different fields that form a multiplet under an extension of the space-time symmetry group, but it's all infinitely big. Now, what about diffeomorphisms? Okay, so in GR, in the spin 2 theory, diffeomorphisms are intimately related and in some formulations can be identified with the spin 2 gauge symmetry. So here this is no longer so. Okay, the spin 2 part of the group is on an equal footing with all the rest of it. Now, the field equations, as we know them, are a different variant. They are written in the language of differential forms, like the Wilbein formulation of general relativity. And this different variance off shell has nothing to do with the higher spin gauge transformations. It's a different symmetry. On shell, a diffeomorphism is always equivalent to a higher spin gauge transformation. But which one will depend on the solution. It doesn't have to be the spin 2 one. Okay. There also exists my alternative formulation where you lose different variance in favor of non-dynamical background spacetime, but that is a separate story. So you have an infinite dimensional gauge group. What gauge groups tend to do is they tend to restrict the kinds of different interactions, terms, and Lagrangian, whatever that you can write. So the common wisdom, there is no proof, but what seems to be true from Vasilev's construction is that if you have the infinite dimensional higher spin group together with parity invariance, then it fixes the interactions completely to all orders and fields, to all orders and derivatives. So this leads to an expectation about quantum theory. So the expectation is that if you can quantize this in a way that preserves all the symmetries, then there's completely no freedom in what the quantum theory can be. Okay? There cannot be quantum corrections to anything except something like setting the scale for the action, setting the h bar and the s over h bar. But that's it. Okay, so this is again like the non-renormalization theorems in SUSY, but on steroids. And to the extent that it can be tested with ADS-CFT, this expectation is borne out. Okay? So for the parity invariant versions of the theory, you can choose boundary conditions that preserve the higher spin symmetry in ADS. This leads to a CFT that is itself higher spin symmetric, and the only such CFTs are the free ones. Okay? And in this CFT, well, in general, in ADS-CFT, the classical bulk limit is taking the number of fields in the CFT to infinity. And for the free CFT, the number of fields is irrelevant, is just an overall constant, like the h bar in the action. So there are no quantum corrections to anything. So this is a funny theory. Now, what do its interactions look like? So still without writing down any equations, some zoological properties. Okay? So there's everything is governed by a single coupling, which we might as well call G Newton. You need, in addition, a non-zero cosmological constant, because you have interactions with all powers of derivatives in them. And derivatives have units which need to be canceled by the units of the cosmological constant in the denominator. So the Minkowski limit is singular. Okay. Everything interacts with everything all at once with all powers of fields and derivatives at all orders, which means that, at least naively, because you need to understand what these words precisely mean, and with some luck, we will manage to talk a bit about this. But at least naively, the interactions are non-local at the cosmological scale, because that's the scale that appears in front of the derivatives. Okay, this is different from string theory, where the interactions are non-local, but at the scale of the string, and there's a separation of scales. Okay, so we don't have that. So whether or not we can really make sense of the fact that the interactions are non-local or not, what is certain is that these are not the interactions of GR already at cubic order. Okay? And the common wisdom is that the only way GR can arise out of higher spin theory is if the gauge group is somehow broken, and then the fields with spins higher than 2 become massive. And there are, in principle, two ways in which this can happen. Okay. One way is to have spontaneous breaking, meaning we have a theory with the exact higher spin symmetry, and it has some spontaneously broken symmetry phase that behaves like general relativity. We do not know of any mechanism to do this. There is no known model. But if you think that higher spin symmetry is the path towards the theory of everything, then you should believe that something like this is possible. Okay. The other possible way to break the symmetry is intrinsic breaking in the process of quantization, because quantization will not necessarily preserve the symmetries. So this means that we have a quantum theory that doesn't have higher spin symmetry. It's not a higher spin theory, but it happens to have a classical limit which is higher spin symmetric, and then it might also have a different classical limit which looks like GR. And for this scenario, we actually have a model. So is this the right symbol for exists? There exists a model, so-called holographic triality in this paper by Shiraz Minwala and friends, where Hairspin theory in ADS4 is claimed to be dual to string theory, and in turn, string theory has GR as a limit. Okay, and in this story, the Hairspin theory is parity violating. So the story we told before about a Hairspin invariant quantization doesn't apply. It's supersymmetric, which we won't cover how to introduce. And it has an extra Young-Mills-like internal space, which we will also not talk about. So this is a fairly high-tech version of the theory, but there exists this proof of concept that Hairspin theory is equivalent to strings, at least in some setup, and similar claims exist in three dimensions. Okay, so this is the end of the zoological part, and of putting the theory into context within the rest of physics. And next, we'll start writing equations. So questions up to here.
In what sense is the number two version there not just spontaneous breaking?
In the sense that you do not have a quantum theory. The fundamental theory is always the quantum theory. Classical limits derive from it. The quantum theory is not higher spin symmetric. As far as I know, and angry callers, please correct me if I'm wrong, when people say that higher spin symmetry is spontaneously broken in string theory, it's speculation. So if you are Vasiliev and you think that it is the theory of everything, then you must think that string theory and or the standard model are spontaneously broken phases, but there is no known mechanism to actually do this. Yes, in the quantum theory, it's explicitly broken and restored in the classical limit. Okay. So, so our task now will be to become boss at thinking about free massless fields of arbitrary spins. Okay, and you can end up with super Young-Mills or Young-Mills if you really meditate on massless fields of spin one, and you can come up with GR if you meditate on massless fields of spin two. So now our job will be to meditate on massless fields as such, and to come up with as unified, compact, and powerful description of them as possible. So first of all, we will need a good language to describe in a unified way all Lorentz representations. And in four dimensions, the best language to do that is two-component spinners, which use the fact that the Lorentz group 031 is double covered by SL2C, so it has a two-dimensional fundamental representation. Okay, and now my apologies to senior people, but not everyone perhaps here knows two-spinner language, so we will introduce some the necessary fundamentals quickly. So the idea is that there are two kinds of two-component spinners. And they're labeled with with little Greek indices and dotted ones. And they are called left-handed and right-handed Weyl spinners. And the right-handed ones are the complex conjugates of the left-handed ones. Okay? Each of the two spinner spaces has a metric, which is the only antisymmetric matrix in 2D, which is the epsilon symbol. And since there is only one anti-symmetric matrix and it's also the metric, so the most powerful feature of this language is that if you anti-symmetrize any two spinner indices, then it's the same thing as taking the trace. So you don't ever need to think about the anti-symmetric objects at all. It is enough to discuss guys who are totally symmetric in their spinner indices. That is tensors of the form like so, with m left-handed indices and n right-handed indices, each one's symmetrized. Okay. And these tensors belong to a representation of the Lorentz group with left-handed spin half m and right-handed spin half n. And these are all the finite dimensional representations of Lorentz. Okay, so if you want to talk about fields of all spins, you just want to talk about all the different kinds of tensors like this. Okay, and anything we can do in tensor language is equivalent to anything we can do in spinner language with an even number of spinner indices, which means integer spin. The translation is carried out by essentially three matrices. So if you have a left-handed spinner times a right-handed spinner, then together they fuse into a space-time vector. If you have two left-handed spinners, and it's enough to talk about the symmetrized combination, then they fuse into an anti-symmetric B vector in space-time. Likewise, with two right-handed spinners. So there, the B vectors in space-time can be split into two different representations. There are the left-handed ones, and there are the right-handed ones, and they correspond to the left-handed and right-handed squared spinners. Okay. Now, there's a particular example of these structures that we will care about a lot, which is so the most important vector in the world is the momentum, the translation generator. So we can think of it either as a vector or as a spinner with two indices like this. And we have the rotation generator, which is a B vector in tensor language. And in spinner language, it becomes a pair of left-handed and right-handed spinners like this. Okay, so this will come up a lot. Okay, so that's all the basic spinner geometry that we're going to need in life. And we're ready to talk about free massless fields. So how do you represent the field strength of free massless spin S field? So the statement, widely known for a while, is that the field strength has two parts, left-handed and right-handed, which one has 2s completely symmetrized left-handed spinner indices, and the other 2s right-handed ones. Okay, so these live respectively in the s comma 0 representation of Lorentz and in the 0, S representation. And the low spin examples of what these guys actually stand for are for spin 1, this is just the ordinary Maxwell field strength. For spin 2, this will be the linearized, because we're talking about free fields, Weyl tensor. And for spin greater than 2, in the higher spin literature, people use the term generalized Weyl tensors. Now, the beauty of spinner language is that the field equation for fields of all spins like this looks always the same. And the free massless field equation is for left-handed fields. So we're taking the covariant derivative. It's a vector, but we can write it with left-handed, right-handed spinner indices like this. And then we can contract one of the left-handed ones. And this is the field equation. And similarly, for right-handed fields. So this writing the field equations like this establishes a democracy between all spins. However, we're going to need more democracy than that to write down higher spin theory. Because as you may remember from QFT books, there is a redundancy. Given a physical spin, there is more than one way to represent it with the Lorentz representation in spacetime. So we will also need a democracy between all possible Lorentz representations corresponding to the same spin. So how does that work out?
There's a question about dimensions.
Yes?
You have you know, differentiate between contracting values and non-dotted indices by contracting all the same indices. What should we know?
Well, the difference is a sign anyway. Right, so it's slightly tricky because the metric is anti-symmetric. So if you exchange upper and lower, you pick up a sign. But other than that, it doesn't matter. And well, no, I personally don't differentiate. So this is not what you usually call the linearized Einstein equation. Because linearized Einstein equation is an equation on the metric perturbation. This is the Bianchi identity on the linearized Weyl tensor. Yes, but if you think that the Weyl tensor is the fundamental field, which on the free level you can, then it's first order. Just like the Maxwell equations are first order in the electric and magnetic fields.
There must be some other Bianchi identity or something to tell you that it's
potential. So it turns out that this is enough. The index symmetries and these field equations are enough to say that there exists a metric that is the potential for this Weyl tensor. Yes. It contains both. The spinner equation contains both. Spinners are neat. Very good. So how do we introduce other Lorentz representations into the story? We take derivatives. So so these guys represent spin S fields, but their derivatives also represent the same spin S degrees of freedom. Now, since we have field equations that constrain the trace, that is the anti-symmetric in spinner indices derivative, then the on-shell independent derivatives are all the ones with spinner indices completely symmetrized. So we have objects like k derivatives of the field with indices like this, all these symmetrized, and up to proportionality, which will show up later, we will define notation for the kth derivative of the field, which will be the same phi, but with the appropriate number of indices. Okay, so this will sit in the s plus half k comma half k Lorentz representation, and the similar construction for the right-handed fields. Okay, so these guys, all the independent derivatives of the field at a point, they span the space of all the linearized, linear in the field, Gaussian-invariant observables that you can ever measure at a point. Okay, if no one ever told you what the fundamental field is, and all you have is a bunch of measuring devices for measuring different field quantities at a point, these are all the different quantities at the point that there are to measure. Okay, they have a geometric interpretation. So if we did not symmetrize the derivatives in any funny way, it would be the Taylor series of the field at a point. But that's not independent because we have field equations. So what these guys are geometrically is they are the Taylor series of the field on the point's light cone, or of the component of the field along the light rays. OK, so cool. Okay, we just spanned in this way all the Lorentz representations, right? Because from the derivatives of the left-handed fields, we have all representations with the left-handed spin larger than the right-handed spin. From the opposite-handedness, we have these representations. And we still haven't covered s equals 0. So s equals 0 should give the balanced representations k half, k half. But we'll get that in a minute. OK, so we have the system with all Lorentz representations, each one appearing exactly once. Now, is there a field equation? Is there a substitute for this field equation that treats all these spins and all representations democratically? OK, and now, this will be the first element of actual higher spin theory, if you will, that we're going to introduce. And the answer is a resounding yes. And such a field equation has a special name near and dear to the theory's practitioners. It's called the unfolded formalism. Or unfolded in equations. So the idea is that instead of expressing the traced derivative of the field like here, we express the entire derivative. So we write the full derivative without tracing or symmetrizing anything of, say, the left-handed spin S field. And then we simply say that it is proportional to, again, we'll fix the constant later, this field with one extra index of each kind. So alpha 1 to alpha 2s and also the index beta all symmetrized and the right-handed index beta dot. Okay. So this equation does simultaneously two things. Okay. First, since it says that the derivative, the full derivative, is symmetric in its spinner indices, and it means that the anti-symmetrization or the trace, which is the same thing, is 0. So it encodes the original field equation on one hand. On the other hand, it encodes this definition of the field with an extra pair of indices as the symmetrized derivative of the fundamental field. And now we just rinse and repeat this for all numbers of derivatives. So we repeat this idea and obtain full equation, which looks like this. So it says that the full derivative of each of those fields in an arbitrary Lorentz wrap, so we can have m left-handed indices and n right-handed indices, is given by, so to be consistent with some conventions of mine, there's an I over square root 2. And then there is the analog of this piece. So it's equal to the field with two more indices in it. Like so, defines this guy as the symmetrized derivative of this guy. And in flat space, that would be it. So this is the flat space piece of the field equation. But we will be living chiefly in the Sitter space with the Sitter radius always set to 1. So in the Sitter space, there is an extra piece. Because if you take two derivatives like this, there is a piece which is a derivative commutator, which is proportional back through the curvature to the original field. So there's also a piece where you take away a pair of indices, essentially an inverse derivative. And here you have the field with one index of each kind less. All symmetrized like so. Okay, and that's it.
Is it all symmetrized there as well?
Trace of what?
Is it all symmetrized in flat space?
So yes, the fields themselves,
right,
with the m and then indices are defined to be symmetric. So the implication is that it's all symmetrized, yes. So this is the curvature correction in DS. Okay, and this is called an unfolded field equation. Okay, so it doesn't know that that these guys are fundamental fields. There are no fundamental fields. On equal footing, there are all the possible fields that encode the same spin s degree of freedom. There's a field equation that gives the full spacetime derivative, which means that if you know all of these phis at a single point, you can just use this derivative to go and evolve to any other point, which of course makes sense, because remember that these fields are the entire on-shell independent Taylor series. So you can just follow it. Okay. Another property of such a formulation is that locality is no longer manifest. Okay. So when it's written like this, with its infinite number of fields and the derivative of each one is related to other guys, it is not obvious that this system can be collapsed, right? The opposite of unfolded, that it can be collapsed back to get equations with a finite number of derivatives on some fundamental choice of the fields. Okay, so this is a language that can, in principle, describe interactions that are non-local in the ordinary sense of the word. However, the unfolded field equation itself, by construction, is always local. It's always first order in derivatives, because it's always true, if you assuming analyticity, that if you have the entire Taylor series at the point, you can calculate everything so you know the derivative away from the point. OK, so we have a language for describing, in principle, non-local symmetries with first-order differential equations. And this is what the Vasiliev equations will look like. Okay, a point that we've been neglecting so far. These equations, of course, make sense only for spin greater than 0, because there has to be an index to contract. Okay. On the other hand, this equation only admits perfectly fine a spin 0 field, which sits in the 0, 0 Lorentz representation. And then derivatives generate these balanced representations. And if you collapse these equations back, then you discover that they contain a scalar field whose field equation is box phi equals 2 phi, which in our conventions with the Sitter space in unit radius means that this field is conformally coupled massless. So in the conformal sense, it's a massless field just like all the others. Okey-doke. Okay, so this is what an unfolded equation looks like. It's pretty neat that such a thing exists, but I don't feel boss yet, because there are all these indices that are buzzing around and making noise in your ears, and I can't be expected to write down interactions when I'm weighted down with something like this. So the next step in becoming boss would be to get rid of all these indices. Now, to do that, we're going to need to take a step back and look more closely at what is this De Sitter or anti-De Sitter space of in which we live, what exactly spinners in it mean, and so forth. So we're now going to make a digression away from field equations back into basic geometry. So before we make it, any questions about this? So there are two equations. I agree that there is a vector's worth of them, but the Maxwell field has two components. It has the left-handed component and the right-handed component. So you get a vector equation for each of them.
And be related by conjugation to each other.
Very well. So if you're that way, I will tell you instead that if you look at only the left-handed equation, then it's a complex vector equation. It has real and imaginary parts, which become the two Maxwell equations when you separate the real part from the imaginary.
Okay, so these fields and their conjugates are not related to each other?
They can be, but in any case, I think I just argued that the full Maxwell equations are contained. If you say that the field is complex, then the left-handed and right-handed pieces are unrelated to each other. And then you have two independent vector equations, which is enough to generate the two complex Maxwell equations. If they are related to each other by complex conjugation, then one of the equations is enough. But now you have a real field, so it makes sense to decompose the equation, which is still complex, into real and imaginary parts. And then those become the two Maxwell equations. Very good. Not in the same representation. Well, what is the equation in the Einstein story? Then the equation has three indices.
So
So you have so the three indices in this equation is one right-handed and three left-handed. So if you transform into tensors, give me a second. Oh, ah, okay. I was beginning the wrong answer. In the Einstein case, So in the Maxwell case, you have two independent equations. You have this one, and you have this one. The spin two analogs of these two equations are not independent. So this is the analog of this is already contained in the analog of this. So, and you don't ever need the Einstein equation explicitly. If you only have the Bianchi identity on the while, then it's enough to deduce that there exists a potential for it that satisfies the Einstein equation. It's not the while itself that has to satisfy the Einstein equation. That will give the differential Bianchi identity on the while. So, well, the well tensor has many index symmetries. So,
the equation there has the symmetry of a hook shaped tableau in terms of ordinary vector Lorentz language.
So the statement is that for the while, you can dualize the two pairs of indices, Hodge dualize them. And then if you dualize this pair, it does nothing to the equation. If you dualize this pair, it turns the equation into a divergence. And I don't know enough Young tableau to answer in that language off the top of my head. Okay. So ho, 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 to the sitter we go. So what does the sitter space look like, as I've been manically saying in every seminar I've given here lately? The sitter space is a hyperboloid in 4D, in 5D flat spacetime. That's the set of radius vectors in R14 Minkowski with unit space-like norm, and we're going to use these capital Latin indices for 5D vectors. Okay. So points in DS are these radius vectors in the 5D space. Tangent vectors in DS can be represented as 5D vectors with the property that they are tangent to the sitter hyperboloid, which means that they are orthogonal to the radius vector. So the sitter vectors are 5D vectors that are orthogonal to the radius vector x. Okay. This condition can be imposed with a tangential projector that brings us down from 5D space to 4D space. That, of course, looks just like this and depends on the point x at which we are. The last useful piece is that the covariant derivative in the sitter can be expressed in terms of the flat derivative in the flat 5D space, just projected back into the tangential space. And all the curvature is in the x dependence of the projection. So you can take a flat 5D derivative and just project everything back into the sitter hyperboloid, and that's the curved covariant derivative. Now, the isometry group of the sitter space is just the group 041 of rotations in 5D under which the hyperboloid is invariant. And this is a simple group. It has intrinsically no natural decomposition into a translation part and the rotation part, as we have for the isometries in flat space. However, at a point, you can decompose the isometry generators. So what do they look like? Like rotation generators in five dimensions are these 5D anti-symmetric B vectors that tell you in which plane you are rotating. Okay, and then once you chose a point X, say that it's 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, so the fourth component is non-zero, then you can decompose this into the radial component 4 and the tangential ones, making a tangential vector, which becomes translations from the point X. And then there's the case when both indices are tangential, and these are the rotations around the point X. It, with the difference that these still respect the de Sitter algebra and not the Poincaré algebra. Okay, so if we, so the commutation relations are as usual, but the commutator of two translations makes a rotation instead of zero. And that is basically the statement that the space is curved, right? That if you, the commutator of covariant derivatives, translations, is a rotation. Okay, so that's all the wisdom that there is about vectors in the Sitter space, but we need more than vectors. We just convinced ourselves that the convenient language for life is spinners. So if vectors in the Sitter space come from vectors in 5D, which are flat, then what do spinners in the Sitter space come from? So spinners of O 3 1 in DS, of course, must derive from spinners of O 4 1 in the 5D flat embedding space. Okay, and how does the spinner representation of O41 works? So here we have the isomorphism that the double cover of O41 is a unitary symplectic group, USP22, and it has a four-dimensional complex representation. So these are four component. They're Dirac spinners. They don't decompose into left-handed, right-handed, or real imaginary parts. We will use for them indices A, B, C, D, and so on. These guys have a name. Okay, so the spinners of the isometry group are called by smart people twisters. Okay, so now everyone knows what a twister is. They are usually taught in the flat space setting, where they're actually a more complicated subject. The non-zero cosmological constant is simpler in this respect. Okay, so in terms of geometric intuition, twisters are to space-time as spinners are to the tangent space at a point. So for those who know, and those who don't know need not bother with it, a spinner, the best way of saying what a spinner is that it's the square root of a totally null B vector in the tangent space at the point. So likewise, a twister is the square root of a totally null plane sitting somewhere in space-time, not tethered to the tangent space. And there's, of course, this whole theory originating with Penrose called twister theory, where the idea is to change focus from space-time to its twister space. And the, And the appeal of that is, first of all, that it's probably a good idea for massless objects, because you know, spinners and twisters correspond to null things, and the massless things are null. And second, that field equations in space-time sometimes end up transmuted into geometry, sort of geometric structures without any field equations in twister space. Okay, and this is the engine behind some of the recent advances in supersymmetric scattering amplitudes, the supersymmetric version of this notion. Okay, and Harrispin theory essentially does the same, but in a different way, with some extra structure involved, which we will get to tomorrow. So I think this is a reasonable place to stop. Questions? All right.
So is the idea that spinners are easier to write in directions?
That spinners are what, sorry?
Are better suited to write in
directions? Yes, because they are better suited to talk about all Lorentz representations at once without worrying about Young tableau and such.
But what about, I mean, I think the first one, if I remember to talk about interactions for ISP, was Weinberg. A long time ago, you wrote the general formula used for that. So does that story connect with this one here?
Not very much. Because the interactions in higher spin theory are peculiar beasts. Right? They are written in the unfolded language involving all derivatives of the field at once. And so if you want to somehow separate it into interaction vertices, then there are infinitely many interaction vertices with you know, all possible powers of the momentum. So it's a bit hard to relate to what people are doing with Feynman rules, with ordinary Feynman rules. And then you know, in ordinary field theory, of course, there are various no-go theorems about why such theories cannot exist. And then they're evaded by introducing cosmological constant and by this you know, infinite orders
about,
business.
About Weinberg. So Weinberg points, you know, as usually is very general. Weinberg point doesn't, you know, doesn't really care about locality or Lagrangian formulation. He just cares about causality, unitarity, and then he writes down the most general. He did that a long time ago, right? Down the most general way higher spin fields can interact with each other without any, you know, just focusing on that the theory is there's an S matrix.
Yes. So S matrix is a asymptotically flat space concept.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about asymptotically flat space. So this is, again, not Kansas. Not that I know, and I don't know much.
But as usual, you know, when Weinberg does something, there's nothing left to do.
Well,
it's a
relation, because in all these cases, you have singular limit when you try to take the cosmological constant to zero.
Well, that is the statement, yes. That's right. We're not talking about asymptotically flat space. We must have a cosmological constant. Then, like, even if you stick to the asymptotic quantities like an S matrix, then they are not an S matrix. They are things like ADS-CFT correlators.
Yeah, of course.
Completely not local on that limit.
It's not. I mean, Weinberg explains it's non-local because you try to write the theory in terms of local fields. But if you write the theories in terms of, we call it the spin S formulation, then I mean, as usual, locality is emergent. But for him, locality is a property of the S matrix.
Yeah. So he's always talking about local interactions in the sense that the S matrix is built from things which are polynomial.
Yeah, exactly. The interactions are local in this sense, but I think the whole problem of the whole noble theorem, if I understand, is that you want to do something more than Weinberg. You want to also have a Lagrangian formulation which is noble, right? Which is whether it's necessary or not.
Yeah. Well, at least in the constructive sense. The status is that with zero cosmological constant, there is no example of a theory, regardless of how much you agree to relax locality. And we have this example with non-zero cosmological constant that we're talking about, and with zero cosmological constant, there is no known example. Perhaps you can do it, but it hasn't been done.
Weinberg
isn't. Well, but does he describe general properties or have an actual theory? Okay. Then I need to add a third row to my table over there.
It's easy to write down local interacting theories of high spinning, even in flat space. You can just use the linearized curvatures, for example, and raise them to arbitrary powers and so on. The Weinberg statement was a no-go theorem that if you want high spin massless particles to interact at low energies, then you can't do it. So it was a statement about the low energy limit to high spin.
You mean, Weinberg and Ripley.
Yeah.
So the fact that, the fact that if they couple to gravity, they don't couple locally to energy. It's also again about the locality of the coupling, but it's not about that they cannot be coupled.
They can't couple by
minimal coupling.
Yeah, because minimal coupling would be a two derivative coupling which would survive at low energies, and that can't happen.
No, okay, so that's tell you about it.
Yeah, so I would agree that if you just go and write down powers of the field strength and put them in a Lagrangian, then in the sense of effective field theory, you can always do it.
That's right, and that's local too. But, so I don't think it's really about low energy.
But
local interactions can't survive at low energy.
But I think effective field theory is one thing, and the complete self-consistent theory is another thing.
Wrong with it is that the interactions don't survive at low energy, so you wouldn't see these fields as long range forces.
But there's also the issue of can you quantize it?
Well, perturbative just as well as GR. Exactly.
So if we agree that perturbative quantum GR has a problem, then these theories are also a problem. Well, higher spin theory apparently can be quantized completely with holography.
So that would be
the theory that you can. Yes, and I agree with Kirk's point that the other issue which GR has and Young-Mills has and higher spin theory has is that you may want to have interactions that use potentials and not only the field strengths, and then they are longer range. You okay?